Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, Backpacking 101. On June 16th, longtime backpacker Michael Waterford met with prospective backpackers to present Backpacking 101. Michael has been on many backpacking expeditions all over the world. He met with community members in Reverend Ernest D. Butler Park to discuss how to survive in the wild, along with first aid, what to buy, and good places to explore. This event was put on by Sycamore Branches.
Well, thanks again for everybody coming. As you all know, this is a Sycamore Branches event. And like I said earlier, feel free to ask any specific questions as we'll go over each kind of individual area. Because there's a lot to cover and not everything will be able to be covered tonight. My email is on this paperwork as well, so if you guys have any lingering questions after tonight, please feel free. I am willing and able to help as much as possible. I love planning trips. It's literally what I do. So, with that being said, we'll go ahead and jump right into it. Backpacking 101, it's pretty straightforward. What we're talking about here is, for those of you that don't know, is heading out to the unknown with all you need in a backpack, a rucksack, and being able to not only survive and thrive out in the woods, out in the wilderness, out in a foreign place that may be populated with a bunch of people, but you need to make sure that all your needs are covered. The first step would be choosing a destination, and that may sound pretty obvious, but a lot of people don't necessarily know how to narrow down exactly. Let's say you want to go to Grand Teton National Park, somebody was just stepping in. But you don't know which trail to do. There's 100 miles of trails there, more than that. How do you know which one to do? There are, first and foremost, guidebooks. I brought a few here, and we can pass them around. Lonely Planet is a very popular one. Brand, I guess, if you would just start that one here. Start that one here. Start this over here. This is the Falcon Guide. I don't recommend going online and looking at reviews. I like guidebooks, I like maps, I like actually doing the research and finding out specifics, even waiting till you get to whatever park you're going to find what trail is the perfect fit for what type of hiking you want to do. So I'm a big fan of, here's a list of other guides you can use. Lonely Planet, Falcon Guides, Rough Guides, Frommer's, Rick Steves, and then there's regional ones as well. Also here, it's funny you brought up, Knobstone Trail and the Adventure Trail, and I have the maps for both of those trails here, and you can pick these up at any of your local outfitters, all the few look at that. Study them, know them a little bit before you get going, just to kind of look and see, you know, how difficult is the trail, is there 8,000 foot climbs that you weren't aware of, and can you handle that type of situation? Magazines, websites, all that good stuff is fairly straightforward. Talk to your world traveler friends. If you want to start backpacking just locally, I've got on here the Indiana DNR website that will take you straight to the list of trails in southern Indiana and the surrounding areas. And they've got reviews of them, they've got mileage, they've got descriptions, how to get to the trailheads, and all that good stuff. If you're also going to a park, stop in the park offices, talk to those that know, because, you know, they live and breathe it every day, and they'll be able to recommend the exact type of trip. I kind of mentioned earlier, make sure that whatever your trip you're planning matches your skill set and abilities. I've got written here, don't get cocky with Mother Nature. She will never cease to surprise you. Consider the terrain and the realistic abilities of your group. And do you want to go see wildflowers? Do you want to find a beautiful vista? Do you want to find waterfalls? Do you want to study some history? So on and so forth, and et cetera, et cetera. What do you want to experience? Consider what you consider fun and not necessarily I want to get it 50 miles this weekend kind of thing. Most recently, I did the Knobstone Trail with a couple of buddies of mine, and I had done it before, but it had been years, and I got humbled pretty hard because I didn't realize there was over 8,000 feet of elevation change in that trail. And so we said, we're going to do it in 2 days, we're going to knock it out, we're going to fast pack it, and really just kick it out. And to do that kind of, it was 48 miles or something like that in 2 days with that kind of elevation and in the rain and the steaming hot summertime was really difficult, and we could have extended it another day. So even myself has been known to get it wrong from time to time. So look into what you're doing is what I'm trying to say. Obviously, this whatever trip you're doing, you know, we tried to do that hiking trip in 2 days to knock it out on a weekend. We should have maybe considered going another day. Does it fit your timing schedule? That's the next tip here. Consider your goals for each and every trip. Do you want to enjoy the campfire, or do you actually want to get a workout in and just pump out miles? Kind of consider what you... And then, as always with wherever you go, consider the local rules and regulations. Let's take, for example, Hoosier National Forest. It's a beloved area here in southern Indiana. Not everywhere in it, though, can you build a fire. So you kind of need to know where you can do that and where you cannot. Most of you can, but there's some places where you cannot. So kind of check the rules and regulations for wherever you go. When you go out west, they'll have fire bans because it gets too dry, and most of the forest fires, they'll be... you know, bears in the area, and they'll shut down entire campgrounds and areas and things like that. So, choosing a destination. Next step, let's say you've chosen a place to go. Now you need to get ready. Robert Louis Stevenson said, "For my part, I travel not to go anywhere but to go. I travel for travel's sake, the great affair to move." So along what I was telling Roy, you can start small, but then also practice camping. Set up camp in your backyard. I did it a bunch growing up, building fires, learning how to do that. Know how to set up your tent, know how to pack your bag. Let's say you need to get in your bag real quick, you know where things are at in your bag, so you pack it similarly every time. Car camp at a local state park is a great way to do it. Around here you can find a recreation area or national forests, or take a short overnight trip with all your backpacking gear. So let's say you're planning that trip out to Grand Teton. Pack up what you think, everything you're going to take on your trip, and then go out to the Deem and spend a night and see, you know, what did I not use? What did I forget? Would I prefer to have this sleeping bag over that sleeping bag? And vice versa, or vice versa. I've got specifics here. Learn the settings of your headlamp, learn how to use your gear, practice packing your backpack so you know where to find everything, and invest the time in your gear so because it can save you headaches later. So just spend a little bit of time out like you would anything else, and it'll make your life easier once you get out in the woods. You don't want to have forgotten a water bottle or whatever. Here's more about what Roy asked. One-night trip makes sense for beginners. Keep your first distance under 10 miles. If you've got more time, consider setting up camp on your first night. Use the next day to relax or take a day hike. Then return to your base camp that night. This way you'll lug a full backpack fewer times. Next option would be ask a friend to join you or jump in on a group outing. Learn from those that are experienced and can lessen the learning curve, as well as ease your mind when you're just starting out going out into the wood. Next step is to be organized. Use the gear checklist to pack smart. Have different checklists for each style of adventure that you want to pursue. Let's like paddling versus backpacking versus climbing. You'll have different stuff for each one. And always, always, always let someone know where you're going. Who's seen the movie 127 Hours? What was the big faux pas? He spent 6 days stuck between a rock and a hard place and had to cut off his arm because he just didn't tell anyone where he was going. So always be sure to do that. And always, not only with this group, but teach your friends, leave no trace. Study that. It should be the basis for how you you backpack, if you're like me, you hit something on a campsite and it's just in ruins from the guy that was there before you. So treat Mother Nature with respect. And then last of all, last but not least, check the weather. Know what to expect. If it's going to be 30 and snowing, you should know that. Don't go out for extended periods of time in the wilderness without knowing what you're getting into. It sounds self-explanatory, but people don't do it, and then they get themselves in trouble. One story of this is I used to live in Jackson Hole near Grand Teton, and there was a group that was taking a summit attempt on the Grand Teton, and a storm blew in, lightning struck the mountain, and there was a lot of injuries because they didn't check the weather. So lesson learned there. Do a little bit of research, find out what you do. Next up, what to bring. Sir Ralph Fiennes says there's no bad weather, there's only inappropriate clothing. I've stolen that many times from him. I've got here a general rule. Whenever I'm outfitting people at work, I always say never, ever, ever carry more than 25 to 30% of your body weight. That though, is a lot. On myself, you know, that's 25%, 50 pounds. I don't want to carry 50 pounds. That's a pain. I tend to try to stop at 20 these days, just because it allows me the freedom to enjoy my hike instead of enjoy being done with my hike. Lay out all of your gear before your trip, and for every item, think to yourself, self, do I really need this item, or do I just want this item? The more weight you can cut out, the easier those uphill climbs will be. Pay attention and keep track of what you actually use on your outings, and remove the excess for your next trip. With every new gear purchase, consider the weight a necessity. Lighter gear is typically more expensive, but will allow you to hike longer and faster. That translates to more fun on the trail. Once your gear ensemble is assembled, think again about what you can do without and which items serve multiple purposes. And again, then pare it down. Consider too, the larger the pack you have, the more you often tend to bring. And so I normally stick with, I've got packs of all different sizes here that we can all try on later. I've got a 75 liter, I've got a 120 liter in the van over there. I've got a 40 liter pack. Normally when I'm going backpacking here, I don't carry any more than this 40 liter. We'll talk about sizing later and what that all means. But I can fit in everything I need and nothing I don't, kind of thing. It's minimizing pack space so that I can enjoy hiking more. So this is my own little system that I kind of thought up over the years. And everybody's heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. When it comes to his triangle, he's got things that keep you alive, and it works its way up to the unnecessities of life, the things that you don't need but makes the amenities, if you will. I am talking about the bare bones, that triangle, the what you need to survive on the trail and in the wilderness. And then later on, we'll get into the amenities and adding on kind of what, you know, pillows and a wine bladder and whatever else you want to bring. The five must-haves, five and alive. Water, a container to carry it, and a way to make more water. Food and plenty of it. Fire, always have two ways of starting a fire. You must stay warm and dry, therefore, or to have fun and be safe on your trip. Clothing is your first line of defense, then shelter, sleeping bags, etc. And then also the backpack in backpacking. How are you going to carry the other four items? So it's kind of what you must have. The next page, we break down what all that means. So, underwater, I said, water, stuff of life, literally, you will die without it. If you didn't know this, stop what you're doing and drink water. When exerting yourself, and I think this is an understatement, but I've had multiple sources say this is the minimum that you need. I often think it's more. Drink at least 2 liters per person per day. I often aim for a gallon whenever I'm really exerting myself. That's for these water bottles or, you know, your Nalgene's or whatever it is. As soon as you get thirsty, you're already dehydrated. So really keep that consistent. And when you come to water sources on the trail, consider each and every one before you walk by it without getting more water. It says here, I try to drink a gallon. It's like I wrote this thing. I try to drink a gallon, bring a water filter and purification tablets with you. Keep in mind water weighs 8 pounds per gallon, therefore you should check your maps ahead of time for water sources so that you're not carrying more or less than necessary. Check with the local ranger station on the status of creeks and springs, which can dry up in certain locations throughout the year. Stash water ahead of time along your route if there is no other source. So again, referencing the Knobstone Trail that I just did most recently, the creeks were gushing, and so we ended up carrying like no water with us the entire time. It was great. That was March. August, it's a different story. You'd have to go, and where roads intersect a trail, drop off a gallon of water ahead of time, and know and have it kind of mapped out with how long you need to make that gallon last, or whatever it is, however much you need. Each trail is obviously different, and if you have specific questions later, obviously we can talk about that. Next up, food. Necessary, period. Plan meals that offer enough calories to fuel your high output days without adding a ton of extra weight. Hard days can sometimes equate to burning up to 4,000 calories. You can take time to cook or save time with ready-to-eat items. Breakfast and dinner should be substantial, while lunch can be a meal or several breaks and snacks throughout the day. I like to do that. I like to take my mornings nice and slow, have a cup of coffee, set off, move all the way throughout the day. Lunch is snacking, drinking water, maybe stopping, and just kind of incorporating that into filtering out more water and things like that. And then dinner is often, for me, enormous. I just pack on the calories as much as I can fit. I've got examples for the snacks. Yugo bars, trail mix, jerky is a great one. Dried fruit, chunks of cheese, and other chews, bars, etc. Again, water is heavy, so you can save weight from your pack with freeze-dried and dehydrated food. I've got a couple instances of it here. This is Backpacker's Pantry. Everybody's seen this. You can get this at any outdoor store, pretty much. They're $5 to $10, depending on what you get. They're edible. They're really not that bad. Have a way to boil water so you can make them. Some of them require cooking. Read the labels. One time I did take one out in the woods where it required cooking, and I didn't bring away a cooking, so I was eating slop that night, you know. So I'll pass this around. They've even got organic versions now, which I'm a big fan of. Dehydrated energy drinks. This is a big one. This is an antioxidant drink by Ju. They're pretty good. They just add some extra carbs and sugar into your water and make it less boring. And then in order to save money, which I know is a big thing for a lot of people, I've actually started making my own meals. So this one's actually a couple months old now, but this is what I eat for breakfast on my desert hike. Every morning I had two meals in each one of these bags. So I would split it in half. In this bag, I've got instant oats, a scoop of protein powder, chocolate chips, almonds, dried raisins, dried bananas, and then I would have, you know, exact portion out for how many days until I get another refuel, you know, kind of thing. So you can pass it around, but you get the gist. There's other options that you can do. That's obviously a breakfast one. Couscous is a great one for dinner because it cooks so quickly. Instant rice is another great option. Summer sausages and dried cheeses are great. Anything that packs on fat and calories. You can't get enough fat and calories when you're doing lots of hiking. Let's see here. Pasta is another one I've got here. Sauces and vegetables. Choose meals with a dry base ingredient such as oatmeal, couscous, or instant rice, but don't sacrifice the little extras, blah, blah, blah. Hot sauce is a great thing to add because it's lots of flavor. Chocolate bars, all that stuff makes the quote-unquote boring dried meals pretty edible. This is a hard lesson learned area. One time I went out, I did 5 days climbing Baker in Washington, and I only took dehydrated stuff because we're packing up packs that are upwards to 100 pounds, all the climbing gear and all that stuff, and I thought, forget it, I'm just going to take dehydrated stuff. And by the end of the fifth day, my stomach was a mess. I didn't want to eat my food because it was so, I was just, all the dehydrated stuff, don't go strictly on that is what I'm trying to think. Take add-on things that are going to get you through. Next up, protect your food. whether it's ants, bears, or other drunk hikers, you'll likely need to protect your food. Store your food in a tent at night, or when traveling in bear country, hang your food from a tree as high as possible, or carry a bear-proof canister. I know it's not necessarily relevant around here, but it's 100% mandatory out west, and most of us do plan on going out west at some point. Does anybody have questions on that? Bear canisters, bear spray, all that stuff you can get in outfitters all across the nation, and it's pretty self-explanatory kind of once you see it.
You've been listening to Backpacking 101 on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Michael Waterford discuss how to protect your food in the wild while backpacking. Michael Waterford is a longtime backpacker and explorer. He met with community members on June 16th to discuss backpacking techniques. We return now to Michael continuing his discussion on backpacking tips and tricks.
So it says consider packing extra food. When you're heading out into the great unknown, you do not want to run out. Like I said earlier, I cut weight on everything and then splurge on extra food and drink. So, I like to treat myself, obviously. Cooking options. So I've got you here. Oh, I forgot to grab my other stove out of the car. Whenever I was first starting out, I used this, and actually I did a 53-day expedition with me and another guy, and all we had for cooking stuff was these two pots and a stove that fit inside it. This is my little windscreen. I got a tiny little baby fork in here. And my gas canister was a third of this size and actually fit in here as well. So we had everything self-contained. It was a motorcycle trip, and the two of us used this. We cooked everything in that. This is the one I brought out here. This is Jetboil. I'm sure most people have seen these. It's great for boiling water. All those instant meals that I just passed around boils water in a flash, which saves fuel, so you don't have to carry extra fuel, which then saves weight. Everything's self-contained. Fits inside of here. Look, I've even got the mini fuel in here as well. It's got a wind stand, so it doesn't blow over with weight on top of it. And you know how to set these up, right? Nope. We're going to learn right now. How's that sound? The fuel tanks are universal. Most every stove made attaches to these types of compressed isofuel, isobutane, if you will. And they just screw on. Super simple. Let's see here. I won't actually start it. This one actually comes with a little lighter. You see there? It just kind of goes on. And there's wind guard sticks on there, so it sticks out straight. And I'll pass this around. Stoves come in many different shapes and sizes. They've got them now that you can plug your phone into and use the heat to charge your phone. I've got one of those. It's not very efficient. You can pass that around and see if you like it. Don't burn yourself. But yeah, they've got ones that just stick up here and just kind of screw in. They're about that tall. They're fine as well. Just if you're going to windy mountaintops, make sure you have a wind guard like I showed you in here. But yeah, stoves are pretty self-explanatory. Just do a little bit of research, find which one you like, and they all kind of work. You know, it's kind of hard to mess up. Where are we at here? We just finished up with food, lightweight stove and backpacking fuel. Make sure to bring more than enough fuel. Boil water, remember to consider your group size. That's another thing. If you're cooking coffee for two instead of one, then maybe that little fuel won't work. And look for a cook set that packs light and small. Cooking over a fire is great. They make these little backpacking grills that go over the fire. You can whittle a stick. You know, it's definitely possible. I've done it a lot of times. Just make sure your pots and pans will withstand the heat.
If you have specific questions on this, I've done a lot too. Just don't cook directly over flame. Pull some coals out. Cook over coals. It works just fine. But it's definitely possible and quite enjoyable when you can do it. Don't forget a bowl and cutlery. I've got a few examples of that. They make these often nowadays. It's a closable lid. You'll have to forgive me. I actually use my stuff here. But it's collapsible. It's lightweight plastic. You can close it up with food in it if you've got stuff left over that you didn't eat a whole lot. Here's another one by Sea to Summit. There's a lot of tech in these simple bowls. They put the extra pads on the bottom so the hot water doesn't burn your hands. They put a thumb thing here with a carabiner loop on it so you can hang things. And it's got a pour stop so you can make pasta and yada, 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 and so forth. Look for the bowl that you think is best. I've implemented a insulated cup into the mix here because I like hot coffee. It's kind of a mandatory thing for me. So that's something that you can I carry. You cannot boil stuff in an insulated cup, just so you know. It will crack it, break it, and immediately ruin your cup. Cutlery is another thing. I've got a couple different options here. You can get these simple things. One's been washed, one's obviously not been. You can get these at any kind of outlet. It's got a bottle opener, a knife, fork, spoon. It's kind of heavy and kind of clunky, but it gets the job done. This is what I use. This is by Sea to Summit. It's titanium cutlery. I like eating like a human. I often pack good food, and so I cut with a knife and fork and use cutlery when I'm out in the woods. That's personal preference. You can get by with those cheap 99-cent forks. They will break on you. I've gone ahead and just invested in quality stuff because I like to eat and eat a lot. So those are kind of dirty. I'm not going to. Don't forget that stuff. Make sure you can eat the food you bring. Fire. Know how to make it. This is the third thing in the top five list of things Michael says to do when you're backpacking. I always make sure I have two ways of making fire. It's like everything that we're talking about. There's a million ways to do it. You know how you want to do it. Some people really get excited about magnesium strips and flints and things like that. Let's see here. Other options being water and stormproof matches. You can get those literally everywhere. Flint and steel, magnesium strip. They've got little fire starters just so many ways. Some that work off steel wool and batteries and all sorts of things. So, think about how and what you want to do to build a fire, and then practice. Go into your backyard. When you're building a fire, you want to consider what's the word I'm looking for? Surface area. You want to make the most surface area you can out of your bundles that you're trying to start a fire from. I know this is hard to explain without actually seeing it, but let's say a bird's nest compared to a chunk of wood, right? A bird's nest is going to have so much surface area wrapped around each individual stick that's going to ignite faster than one chunk of wood. Does that make sense? So the more surface area you have in an object, the better it's going to burn and the faster it's going to burn. Also, when starting a fire, make sure that you've already pre-made firewood to put on top of the light that you make. Oftentimes when you're backpacking, it's going to be wet and rainy and gross, and when you finally do get a flame, you really want that fire and you don't want it to go out, so you don't want to leave a little baby fire to go get firewood. Have it already ready, have things set up, so when you do get a flame going, you can just add on. Keeping warm and dry. This is step four. This is kind of the all-encompassing big picture thing of being outside. It includes your clothing and your sleeping system. So your clothing is your first line of defense when you're out in the woods. You can survive without a shelter for a night or two or whatever if you have to. If you've got the proper clothes, you're safe. First rule, everybody knows this, no cotton. Cotton when wet steals your body heat, takes forever to dry. There are a million different blends of wool and polyester and other synthetic materials that they make out of all sorts of stuff these days that offer quick drying, warm when wet clothing that can really take a beating and last you a really long time. For summertime, I actually wore them here this evening. The kind of low height, just kind of sturdy sole, but lightweight hiking shoe. But if you go on, if you're carrying a big pack, let's say upwards of 50 pounds, you definitely want to raise that up and have like a mid-height layer to protect your ankles from rolling. It's a matter of preference. You know what footwear you like. Just make sure it's got a good grip. It's got a tough sole so it can handle rocks and it doesn't beat up your feet. Take care of your feet when you're out in the wilderness. We'll go ahead and read this thing here. Full or mid-height hiking backpacking boots are the standard when carrying a heavy load. I prefer using hiking shoes or even trail runners because they're more lightweight and comfortable. Generally, the longer your trip, the heavier your pack, the more heavy duty your boot will need to be. The breathability and waterproofing and the weight of the boots or shoes are all important factors to consider. I'm wearing my favorite summer hikers. These are the Garmin Negevi. They've treated me well. I've done a few hundred miles in them, and I'm able to wear them to work still. They're just good shoes that I know and trust. So find out what that is to you, and kind of only you can kind of figure that out. Socks are a good one. If you're going out and really pumping out miles, you want to wear two pairs of socks. That's blister control. Makes the friction between the two layers of socks instead of your foot in the sock. So it's kind of a standard. Wigwam, which is a sponsor here tonight, gave everybody a discount for 20% off their socks. And then, sorry, I did mention it, the shoes. If you didn't get a Garmin card, let me know and I'll get you one later. But it's 60% off their boots, which they make really, really good stuff. Yeah, back to socks. A merino wool blend is definitely, again, no cotton. You can't really find a company out there, all the smart wools, all the wigwams, all those companies nowadays, they're all merino wool based socks. So, summertime, go thinner. Wintertime, go thicker. Kind of pretty self-explanatory there. Make sure your feet are warm and well maintained. So then we get into clothing. General here is think layers, obviously non-cotton. So, the point of layers is that if you're hot, you can strip layers off. If you're cold, you can strip layers on. The general outline for this, what this looks like, is you've got your base layers. That includes your underwear, all synthetic stuff. Then you've got an insulating layer, and then you've got an outer weatherproof shell. And so what that looks like for me is I've got synthetic Patagonia makes this stuff called the R1 series, I think is what it is. But it's all synthetic. It's got this grid fleece in line. It's super warm, super quick drying, and super lightweight. It really works well. And then my mid layer looks like just a normal pair of hiking pants because that kind of doubles as an insulating layer for my legs. And then I've got a long sleeve synthetic tee. And then we're going to have some kind of down puffy. If you don't know what that is, let me know. But it's kind of a either a down or a synthetic down puffy jacket. Everybody's got one these days. They're kind of trending right now. And then outside of that is going to be your weatherproof shell. I did bring mine. I trust Gore-Tex. Everybody should trust Gore-Tex. But it's saved my butt a couple times. Just make sure that whatever weatherproof shell you bring is actually waterproof and windproof. My least favorite thing is having gear that doesn't work, and a lot of raincoats out there don't work. I work at Dick's Sporting Goods, and my boss wouldn't appreciate me saying this, but the raincoats we sell there, I can't recommend to people going really out backpacking because they don't do a good job. Sure, they're good for podunking around town. They're going to keep you dry short term. But if you're out in the middle of the Andes and it starts coming down on you for 3 days straight and you've got nowhere to go, you need something that's going to resist water long term. For that, I trust strictly Gore-Tex products. So, and they're just worth their weight in gold. You pay $200 for the jacket now, but it's going to last you 15 years. My dad got me one when I was 8 or 9. We've been to Canada a few times in it. Done a lot of stuff in that jacket. I took it on that 53-day expedition across Europe and Asia, and just beat the tar out of it. Tough stuff, that Gore-Tex, trust it. But we'll go ahead and read through this to make sure I covered everything. The base layer, again, synthetic shorts and a tee for summer, long underwear made with a wool blend or synthetic materials for colder months. Your undies should be sweat-wicking and non-cotton, too. Your insulation, think layers here, make sure you've got options. Consider the weather, layer up when you're cold, layer down when you're hot. You know you. I trust you can dress yourself. Just make sure you've got enough to keep yourself warm. Your wind and water shelf, never leave home without a rain jacket. If it's colder, bring rain pants too. If it's summertime, I'm okay with my legs getting wet if it's raining. If it's time to go to bed, I'll take off my wet pants and just sleep without pants. If it's warm out, you're good. Wintertime, if you're wet, you're miserable. So do whatever you have to do in the wintertime to stay dry. It's a huge deal. It says here again, there's a million options out there, but to me, nothing protects like Gore-Tex. And then my other essential clothing items, I never leave home with a sun hat or a beanie, depending on winter or summer. Sun hat is huge. I've had sun poisoning a couple times, so you don't mess around with the sun. A beanie, keep your head warm. You lose something like 90% of your body heat through your head. Keep your head warm. Gloves, I bring gloves even in the summertime. I use trekking poles that help protect against blisters if it gets cold out at night. I can, one, collect wood with gloves on so you don't need to worry about getting briars, breaking a nail, whatever it is you're worried about. But it also keeps your hands warm. So gloves are a necessity. Sunglasses, I prefer sunglasses over a sun hat unless the sun is really beating down on me. So that's kind of how I do it. Again, you do want to protect your eyes from, especially in wintertime, reflection off snow and stuff. You can get snow blindness. In summertime, it's just nice to have. So, camp shoes is another thing. A lot of people bring Crocs, flip-flops, something to change into after you get out of a long hike. You've done 15 miles, let's say, today, and you show up to camp, and there's nothing like taking off those shoes and resting the feet by the fire. But you need to move around camp, and your camp shoes are drying out by the fire. To have another set of something to walk around camp with is a very nice amenity and almost a necessity. So that's clothing. That's your first line of defense. Does anybody have any questions about it at all? All right.
You've been listening to Backpacking 101 on Stand and Groom Only on WFHB. Michael Waterford discussed clothing options and necessities to bring while backpacking. Michael is a longtime backpacker and explorer here in Bloomington. He has traveled all over the world backpacking and knows many tips and tricks on how to survive in the wild. We return now to Michael speaking to the audience about necessary sleep systems.
Next up, then, we're getting into your sleep system. First up with that is your sleeping bag. Down insulation versus synthetic, it's a big question on what people want to do. Down insulation has a better warmth to weight ratio. And they're making down with waterproofness now, and so it's practically as good as synthetic stuff. The big argument is synthetic stuff, when it's wet, it's still warm. So what we're looking for here is insulation, a sleeping bag that creates insulation. Down, for many years, the problem was whenever it got wet, the down fluff would compress, and therefore you'd lose all your heat and insulation. So synthetic solved that problem, but it doesn't compress and it's super heavy to carry and lug around. So science has come around recently and they put a layer of waterproofing over each feather, and it kind of prevents that from happening. It actually does a really good job, and I do highly suggest it if you're thinking about longer distance stuff or serious backcountry stuff. Get a down defender. There's a million different names, but it's got a durable waterproof finish over the feathers and sleeping bag. So you get the the warmth to weight ratio that's good, and also the waterproofness. So that's kind of the money spot for your sleeping system. Next up, the sleeping pad. You can go inflatable or closed cell foam. I brought an example of an inflatable pad. This is a fairly simple one by Big Agnes. This is the Aircore SL. This is strictly just pretty much a balloon in the shape of a mattress. It packs up super small, maybe the size of a pop can. Weighs very little. You guys are welcome to pass around as well if you want to. But what it does is it just gets you off the ground. The ground can really steal your heat away at night, especially in the fall and spring. So you want to get yourself up off the ground, literally, not figuratively. The closed cell foam option, I don't have an example of, but it's closed cell foam. It's just dense. Often we've seen the Z fold. I really like those. Ann and I are going to be bicycling Highway 1 coming up soon, and I'll be taking one of those because the great thing about it is they are indestructible. You can light them on fire and they still work as a sleeping pad. This guy, if you put a pinhole in it, it's done. So depending on where you want to go, if you're sleeping on a lot of pointy rocks, maybe take a closed cell foam pad, put that down underneath that if you need more padding, do whatever you got to do, but make sure it doesn't go flat on you or what have you. I like the closed cell foam pads too because you can sit around the fire on them. You're doing a lot of ground sitting when you're backpacking, sitting on rocks, sitting on trees, to have a separation layer between you and whatever you're sitting on, and to be able to sit around the fire at night and not have to worry about coals popping out in your sleeping pad is pretty nice. So, again, you've got options. They make them big, they make them small, they make them heavy, they make them light, they make them cheap, and they make them super expensive. So, do what you want. They actually make them now that are insulated, and so you can get down or synthetic insulation inside of a sleeping bag, which amps up what they call the R rating. That's how warm it keeps you at night. That's super important if you're going to sleep in hammock because you've got airflow underneath you and that can steal your heat away, or just the cold ground. So again, a million options. Do some research, find out what's best for you. And that's sleeping pads. Next up, the shelter. So I set up my freestanding two-person tent over here. This is what I take on all my expeditions. This is the MSR Hubba Hubba 2. It's super popular in the backpacking world. It's tough as nails. It only weighs 3 pounds. I can fit myself, tons of gear, and all that stuff in it. But the reason I suggest a freestanding two-person tent for any solo backpacker starting out is, one, a two-person tent allows for space. Let's say you're on top of a mountain and a storm rolls in and it's raining for 3 days straight. Happened to me, you're stuck in your tent so much, you need some room to play cards with a friend. You need room to breathe and to keep your gear dry. Two-person tents gives you enough space to do that without adding on too much weight. You can get away with solo tents. I don't recommend that's where everyone start out, which this is kind of what we're aiming at here. The hammocks and rainflies, super popular right now. I set one up over here. This is the Grand Trunk double hammock. I've had a number of these over the years. They're great. What I've done is I took some paracord, doubled it up, put some knots in it, wrapped it around a post. Remember, 5 and alive, when you're hanging a hammock or climbing, 5 inches, and it's secure. So I didn't go around the small beam. You'll notice that's less than 5 inches. 5 inches is what can hold body weight normally. Sleeping in a hammock, it doesn't give you as many options as a tent. You can put a tarp over it, sure, but then your gear's still on the ground. And there are some pretty fancy hammocks out there. But to me, it's one of those things where if I'm going on a serious backpacking trip, I'm not going to take a hammock. I want a shelter that I know and trust and that I can set up anywhere. Sorry, I didn't mention this earlier. The reason that freestanding tent is better, some tents you have to stake into the ground to set up. What if you're on rock? What if the ground is frozen? I want a tent that I know that I can set up anywhere and it's going to stand alone and be a shelter. I may not be able to have the guy lines out. I may not be able to have the rain fly completely secured, but in the end, it's set up and I'm dry. So That's kind of my recommendation on where to start. You can get things like that. That particular tent's like $500. It's ridiculous. But you can get them for like $30 at Dick's Sporting Goods. They get the job done. They're still super light and super small. And get started for relatively cheap. So shelters are, again, a million different options. Find out what you want. Consider your environment. Consider where you're going. If you're doing a lot of winter camping, consider a single layer tent. This tent is two layers. It's got a kind of, everyone's seen it. It's got a bug mesh and then a rain fly over the top of it. So beautiful nights like tonight, you could just do the bug mesh and have a view of the stars. Right? So the rain fly is necessary though. Next up, carrying it all, the backpack and the backpacking. So, if you guys want to see it, I've brought three out. I've got more, a million different sizes, shapes, and amenities in these things. We've actually got a couple of Dorian backpacks here, a Gregory backpack, three different sizes. This is 40 liters. This is 55, a women's specific pack. This is actually Anna's. And this is my 75 liter when I take on my longer backpacking trips. So the capacity, generally speaking, they go by liters. And the name of this thing, this is called the Z, and this is called the Kaika. And then there's always a number associated with it. This is the Z40, 40 liters. It's the Kaika 75, 75 liters. Pretty self-explanatory. They put the number in the name. So the common size for weekend trips, 1 to 3 nights, is 35 to 50. I've been doing this a while, so I can get my longer trips in a 40 liter. Multi-day trips, 3 to 7 nights, require 55 to 80 here. And then for longer trips, you can go bigger. On my desert expedition, I took a 120 liter backpack that I had in the van, just because I was carrying so much winter gear, that I just needed extra space. So consider your trip. Next in backpacks, consider the backpack features you prefer. It says here, do you want a hydration sleeve? I didn't mention this when it came to water, sorry. Jumping all around. I did practice this speech, but you know how it goes. This is a hydration sleeve. It's a 3 liter bladder made by Camelback. What this does is it fits inside your backpack, inside obviously, here, and then this nozzle sticks out. So when I'm wearing my pack, this nozzle sticks out and I can just drink from the hose that's right here instead of having to get a water bottle out of my pack each time I want to take a drink. They're a nice amenity to have. It's, again, a matter of preference whether or not you prefer that over a water bottle. They both work. I carry normally this and this bottle because in a pinch I can boil in this, but I have the capacity to carry a lot if I need to with this. And most backpacks these days will come with the bladder sleeve. Some don't, though. But consider that if you want, when you're buying your pack, you prefer an internal frame to an external frame. Some people are old school. I've had an internal frame pack. Look, these are all three internal frames. This one does a great job of showing you here. This actually has a wooden frame. It's an environmentally friendly pack. But you can see it kind of there. So that's pack. External frame pack, it's just like literally aluminum piping on the outside and just kind of straps up to it and might have a bucket of fabric sewed onto it so you can put things in it, but literally the frame is external. It's kind of an old school way to do it. They're known as being somewhat less comfortable as these guys that kind of engulf you a little bit better as far as carrying a heavy load. But I did do a backpacking trip through Europe with an external backpack, and I will say it worked very well, just as good as any of these. So again, it comes down to preference at that point. Let's see here. Here's another thing. When you're shopping for a backpack, consider a company with a lifetime warranty. Let's say money's tight, you go to my lovely employer, Dick's Sporting Goods, and you say, I just want the cheapest backpack there is. You can get out the door for $30 or whatever, and you get a backpack that'll take you around the world. That's great. As soon as that backpack rips, though, if you're using it a lot, you're done. All these backpacks are made by companies with a lifetime warranty. Something breaks, you can call that company. They'll either take care of you for free or make you pay for whatever part that's there. They're there for you, and oftentimes, I mean, you again, referring to Wild, she had shoes with a lifetime warranty, and they were giving her problems, and she called the company, and they sent her a new pair of shoes for free while she was on the trail. So companies, outdoor companies, are really good about taking care of the people. It's generally worth the extra money that you have to pay to get the type of gear and then the care that they give after you purchase. It says here, again, spend as much or as little as you like. I'm almost embarrassed to admit it, but I've got some pricey gear these days. This thing was about $450 again, but I wanted to get super environmentally friendly. This is a cotton backpack with a wood frame, so it actually has a very little carbon footprint, which I really, really like and wanted to pay the extra money for. But you can get out there, like I said, with some very cheap backpacks that are, you know, $20-$30. So, but it's worth spending some time on money and comfort or whatever your priorities may be. So, sizing the backpack. This is often a difficult thing. Individual sizing, if you want me to do this with your packs later, I'm happy to do it. So they measure backpacks by your torso size. Roger, can I do that? They measure between your hip bones, the side bone that sticks out, you can feel it in your person right there. You can kind of feel it if you do that. They measure from there to your C7 vertebrae, which is the little bump that sticks out in the top of your back, the bottom of your neck kind of deal. Call that your C7 vertebrae. Thank you. So whenever they go small, medium, large, depending on the company, however they market it, that's the measurement that they're doing. And so you can go to any of your local outfitters, and they've got sizing charts and things that can do that. Oftentimes the sizes overlap too, so I can fit into a medium in one bag and a large in the other, depending on the company. So just try it on. When you're in the outfitter, put some weight in the bag, carry it around the store for 5-10 minutes, make sure it's comfortable. What you want to do when you put a bag on, real quick, is to make sure it fits you properly. All the weight should always be on your hips. It should not necessarily be on your shoulders. That's a kind of misconception. So let's say I'm headed out, I'm picking up on the trail. What I want to do is I want to, like, come to it myself. Lift my shoulders up, right? Tighten the bag as tightly as I can around my waist. And then kind of let my shoulders down. So I've got this extra space up here. And so the weight is solely on my belly and centered over my hip bones that I was mentioning earlier. And then I tighten it around here and kind of just keep it snug close to my person. And then you can do your sternum strap, tighten down your shoulder straps, keep it comfortable. I'm constantly adjusting when I'm hiking. If I start to get a rub in a place, I'll change it up. Do what you need to do to stay comfortable and stay moving forward. I don't care how expensive the bag is, sometimes it's going to run you off. So just do what you got to do, kind of thing. How to pack your pack. When loading and adjusting your pack, keep heavy gear close to your person, as close to your back as you can, and keep it centered over, centered in the backpack. Do your best to balance weight throughout the pack. Heavier items centralized and closer to your person. The lighter items packed around them. Don't be afraid to attach gear to the outside of your pack. If you run out of room inside, don't do it purposely. If you can't keep things inside, do it just because it allows things to stay contained and doesn't flop around on you when you're moving and shaking and getting snagged on trees and brush and all that other stuff. But you can do it. I mean, they put all those latches. You've got, if you're mountaineering, you've got ice axes and things like that. All that stuff will only fit on the outside. So you definitely can do it. I often keep my rain jacket, snacks, my foam pad, all those things on the outside of my pack, so that if it starts raining, I can just quickly grab my rain jacket and grab my snacks. If I want to take a seat for a second, I can just pull out my foam pad and sit down, whatever's dirty around me, things like that. So, but when it comes to packing, oftentimes people, in order to keep the weight centered in their bag, they'll put their sleeping bag on the bottom. Sleeping bag companies backpack companies have started listening to this and often put sleeping bag pockets. This one has one on the bottom here. You can kind of see it. It's actually meant for your sleeping bag there. And what that does is it lifts everything up. Lightweight, big puffy thing on the bottom, keeps the weight centralized in the bag. Does that make sense? Next, so that's kind of the top five you're alive in the wilderness stuff. I mentioned the personal location beacons that can be tracked and send your location to authorities. Those are great. If you're going seriously far out, it's worth it. Little acronym for if you do get lost, STOP. S stands for stop, T stands for think, O for observe, and P for plan. The stop part, as soon as you notice you're off track or uncomfortable with your surroundings, take a break, keep calm. If you're lost, don't just keep going. Go back to where you once were. If you can remember your last spot, head back there and make sure you can get your way back. And think. Use your head, not your legs. Where were you last certain of your location? Can you get back there? Are there any distinct landmarks along your route that you can navigate to? If so, carefully return to that point and then reevaluate your options. Next up, observe. As you're going, pay close attention to your surrounding. Put your senses on full alert and think of your path and location. And then plan. Work out a plan if you're lost. Follow it. Feel free to reassess along your way and revise your plan as situations change. Continue this process until you find your way out. If you're unable to come up with a plan, stay put. It's easier for rescuers to find you near your original line of travel. You hear about people being lost and then just not using their brain, using their legs, and only getting themselves in more trouble. If you truly don't know what to do, stay put. Build a fire, find camp, settle in. Someone will eventually find you there, and it's better to be prepared and make yourself, one, as comfortable as you can, but two, as visible as possible.
You just listened to Michael Waterford discuss tips and tricks on surviving in the wild while backpacking. Michael is an expert backpacker and explorer and has traveled all over the world to backpack. This workshop took place on June 16th at Reverend Ernest D. Butler Park. Michael talked about the five necessities needed to survive in the wild, and he talked about where to buy materials as well as insider tricks. This event was put on by Sycamore Branches.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.